Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting. Senior U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says the time has come to start moving dependents of U.S. military personnel out of South Korea. He appeared on the CBS News program Face the Nation.
We're getting close to military conflict because North Korea is marching toward marrying up the technology of an ICBM with a nuclear weapon on top that can not only get to America but deliver the weapon.
Graham's comments followed those by U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, who explains the threat from North Korea.
So this would be the most destabilizing development, I think, in the post-World War II period. And it's something that places us at direct risk, but places the world at risk.
North Korea launched an intercontinental ballistic missile last week, and following previous launches, claimed its projectiles can hit any part of the continental United States. Gun battles erupted in the Yemeni capital Sana'a as the alliance between the Iran-backed Shiite rebels known as Houthis and former President Ali Abdullah Saleh appeared to have fallen apart. Former U.S. Ambassador David Mack now with the Middle East Institute in Sana'a.
But he's also somebody who wants to enjoy a good relationship with Western governments and with the United Nations. He showed that when he was in power in Yemen before and when he was a close partner of the United States in dealing with certain terrorist activities that were having their base from within Yemen.
Clashes erupted last week when Saleh accused the rebels of storming his giant mosque in Sana'a and attacking his nephew. In western Zimbabwe, a deadly traffic accident left at least 21 dead when a truck overturned. A low spokesperson said that all were injured when the driver lost control. This is VOA News. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is warning a U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and moving the embassy from Tel Aviv could destroy the Middle East peace process. Reports are indicating that President Trump might make an announcement as early as today declaring U.S. recognition of Israel as the capital but put off physically moving the U.S. embassy. Michael Fishbach is a Middle East scholar at Randolph-Macon College.
Israeli-Palestinian peace process that the U.S. has been trying to shepherd. It's a game changer as well in that it marks a drastic shift in American policy.
United States has always said the future Jerusalem must be settled as part of a Middle East peace deal. Mr. Trump made designating Jerusalem the Israeli capital one of his campaign promises. Abbas has been actively speaking out against such a move. U.S.-backed Syrian Kurdish rebels say they have fully cleared territory in Deir ez-Zor, east of the Euphrates River, of Islamic State fighters. A spokesman for the YPG militia praised local tribal leaders as well as both the United States and Russia for airstrikes and logistical support. IS militants also have been under pressure from the Syrian government forces. President Trump, in a series of tweets, attacked the Federal Bureau of Investigation and said he never asked then-FBI Director James Comey to stop investigating his one-time National Security Advisor Michael Flynn about his contacts with Russia's ambassador to Washington. On Friday, Flynn pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about conversations he had with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak in the weeks before Mr. Trump took office in January. Flynn said he would cooperate with investigators looking into alleged Russian meddling in last year's U.S. election and whether the Trump campaign colluded with Moscow. Jack Rice, criminal defense attorney and former CIA agent.
What this means is they're getting absolute cooperation from Mike Flynn, which means he's going to gut himself and give them everything that he's got and anything else that he can get. But what makes this most significant is he makes the point very clear that he didn't do this alone. His contact with the Russians wasn't a rogue operation.
Some have suggested Michael Flynn was in direct contact with persons at the top of the Trump transition team, possibly even Mr. Trump himself. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com. And we're always available on the VOA mobile app.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, December 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe says lifting sanctions would depend on positive actions by the new government.
Videra is an act of Congress approved by the President of the United States. For any movement on that, the President and Congress would have to act. That said, the United States' decision is always based on activity that's positive.
Harry Thomas Jr. is the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe. For the first time since 1969, Somalia launches a process to register independent political parties. Gambia touts progress in promoting press freedom on the first anniversary of Yahya Jammeh's overthrow. And the heads of United Nations missions in West Africa urge an expeditious conclusion to Liberia's electoral process.
The heads of missions express hope that the electoral process would be concluded expeditiously, stressing that legal challenges should be legitimate and in good faith.
Mohamed Ibn Chambers is the special representative of the Secretary General for West Africa and the Sahel. South Sudan's government says it is committed to improving the 2015 peace agreement and slavery through the eyes of an artist. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's portion, our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe says lifting U.S. sanctions on Zimbabwe would depend on positive actions by the new government. The United States has imposed sanctions on individuals and entities under the then-President Robert Mugabe's government for what the U.S. called acts to undermine Zimbabwe's democratic process or institutions and acts of violence and other human rights abuses against political opponents. Ambassador Harry Thomas Jr. says removing those sanctions would also require actions by both President Donald Trump and the U.S. Congress.
As you know, Zadera is an act of Congress approved by the President of the United States. For any movement on that, the President and Congress would have to act. That said, the United States' decision is always based on activity that's positive, that points in a new direction. That is why in the last year we have removed individuals and entities from the sanctions list who really had changed their performance. That is always open in the future, but again, that's a decision up to the President of the United States and our Congress.
We understand that there's a U.S. Delegation in Zimbabwe. Who exactly is there, and do you know what their mission is?
Yes, Representative Daryl Issa, Republican, representing San Diego and Orange counties in California, was here from midday Friday to midday today. He departed for home. I think he gained valuable insight by talking to people across a broad spectrum of this new democracy. So he met people in the opposition, in government, in civil society, human rights activists. Everyone that you would expect would be able to give him their views of not only the past and the need for reconciliation and justice, but also what they would like to see happen in this wonderful country where we're just seeing an explosion of freedom of speech and laughter and criticism and sarcasm. It's almost like we're back in Washington.
But, Ambassador, there was also a question that many are asking. Does Washington consider this a military coup, a guided coup, or a popular revolt?
Well, clearly the Zimbabwean people were involved in a peaceful change. And the most important thing is we see how we go forward. We would like to see democracy flourish. And whatever short-term arrangements the government has established, the path must lead to free and fair elections. I think that is important. I think also, as the Secretary of State said, Zimbabwe has an extraordinary opportunity to set itself on a new path. And I think most people would agree to that.
And to what extent is Washington willing to assist Zimbabwe achieve its goals economically?
Well, first of all, remember, we remain the largest bilateral and multilateral donor. with over $250 million in bilateral aid each year. We're the largest contributor to the global fund, largest contributor to the United Nations. And when you look at that, the jobs that it creates have been tremendous. Also, we hope that you're eager to see our wonderful new embassy blessing that should open sometime in 2018 that has created over 700 jobs for Zimbabweans of, in duration 1 to 3 years. So we're already an economic force. But what we would like to see is the involvement of the American private sector, particularly Zimbabwean Americans. But we know that Zimbabwean Americans, or everybody in the world, is only going to spend the money and invest if the economic conditions are right. Now, President Mnangagwa said he's going to set the conditions right, and we clearly have to give him time. And if that happens, I think you will see investment from the United States and from all over.
Harry Thomas Jr. is the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe. He was speaking with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service. For the first time since 1969, Somalia has launched a process to register and issue accreditation certificates to independent political parties. This is a major step towards holding popular elections in less than 4 years. The country's National Independent Electoral Commission on Sunday registered the first 7 political parties, one of which is headed by a female. Halima Ismail Ibrahim, the chairperson of the Somali Elections Commission, has described the development as historic.
38 years, we are today realizing to have a political party, because the last political party that we had was 1969. Secondly, having political parties, it will eliminate the process which was based in 4.5. From now on, the process will be based on one person, one vote, and political parties will be the runners of this that political action.
And how many political parties have you registered today?
So far, we have registered 7 political parties, and it is temporary political parties registration.
What do you mean by temporary?
It is temporary because still they are not permanently registered. To be permanently registered, it needs to fulfill a lot of requirements. We have a political party registration, and the political party registration says to become a political party, you have to have an office in the capital, you have to have sub-offices in 9 regions of the country, you have to have 10,000 members which are dispersed and distributed to the 9 regions. They must have a candidate. They must submit a list of candidates. After being checked that candidates, they will be able to run for election.
So are you guaranteeing that the next elections in Somalia in 2020 or 2021, they will be competed by political parties rather than influence of clan elders choosing the MPs and the president?
One of the pillars for one person, one vote election is to have political parties who will be the running mates. So having this temporary political party will lead us to fix it and political parties. And those will be those who are running for election. And from that, the election will be one person, one vote. Means that we are overpassing the 5.5, and everyone, each citizen in Somalia, will be able to go and vote wherever and whoever they want.
But most of the political situation in Somalia is dictated by the security. If the security does not allow you to hold one person, one vote elections or popular elections in 2020, what's going to happen?
Our assumption is to have a security, and we will have security if all Somalis work for that, especially the government. And if we get the support of the parliament and the belief that we are getting, we will have security.
How are you educating Somalis about political parties, multi-party system, after such a long time, nearly 50 years of absence of multi-party system?
We have 7 objectives. One is to educate the Electoral Commission, because this is the first time that we had an electoral commission. The second thing is to prepare all the legal frameworks for election. The third thing is to educate the whole Somali.
Halima Ismail Ibrahim is the chairperson of the Independent Electoral Commission of Somalia. She spoke with reporter Haroon Maruf of VOA Somali Service. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, December 4th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. This week could be a pivotal week in the ongoing legal challenges to Liberia's October 10th presidential election, as the country's Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling whether there should be a rerun of the October 10th election or a runoff between incumbent Vice President Joseph Boakai of the ruling Unity Party and Senator George Weah of the Coalition for Democratic Change. Meanwhile, a high-level meeting of heads of United Nations missions in West Africa met Friday in Liberia's capital, Monrovia, to discuss developments in West Africa, particularly Liberia. Mohamed Ibn Chambas is the special representative of the Secretary General for West Africa and the Sahel.
The heads of missions lauded the peaceful nature of the 10 October elections in Liberia. They noted that compliance with the rule of law and due process is essential for strengthening Liberia's nascent democracy. The heads of missions expressed hope that the electoral process would be concluded expeditiously, stressing that legal challenges should be legitimate and in good faith. They emphasized that the will of the Liberian people must be respected. The heads of missions also noted the importance of complying with the constitutionally mandated date for the inauguration of the new government in January 2018. In this connection, they underscored the need for all parties and stakeholders to exercise restraint, uphold the rule of law, and conduct all activities with civility and in a non-violent manner, including in their public discourse.
The UN officials also emphasized that peaceful, free, fair, and transparent elections in Liberia are a prerequisite for consolidation and sustainability in Liberia.
They made it clear that the destiny of Liberia remains the responsibility of all Liberians, while emphasizing that the international community needs to continue assisting Liberia's development beyond the conclusion of the electoral process and UNMIL's withdrawal.
Fariz Zarif, Special Representative of the Secretary General for the UN Mission in Liberia, known as UNMIL, defended the mission's 14-year presence in Liberia, which he said has cost $7.5 billion, against criticism by some that the UN presence is seen as interfering in the internal affairs of Liberia.
We came here with 16,000 troops. We spent here 14 years. We spent $7.5 billion. In order to do things that are inherently Liberians. The breakdown of law and order was a Liberian situation. The breakdown of governance and rule of law in the country was a Liberian situation. We came here to help you fix those things. Do you consider that interference? If we now tell you that the law that you have created in your own free will, and you are expecting everybody to abide by that, if we tell you to respect the law, would that be interference? And do you also think that it would be interference if we tell you that all the investments that you have made throughout these years and all the investments we as the international community have done in bringing Liberia from its immediate past conflict to where it is today, would it be interference for us to tell you to sustain this, preserve it and build on it? Don't allow the country to slip back into a conflict. Don't give up on your insistence on the law, on due process. Would that be interference? If we were to be guided by the trend so far, I would say there is no reason for us to be worried.
And that was Fariz Zarif, a special representative of the Secretary General for the UN mission in Liberia, known as UNMIL. Gambia says it has made progress in promoting press freedom on the first anniversary of Yahya Jammeh's overthrow. Minister of Information Demba Jao says for the first time, the Gambia has an independent television station.
I can assure them, sir, the government is doing extremely well on that area. You know, I mean, as far as the media is concerned, it promised that we're going to liberalize the areas, you know, give them enough room to do their work without any harassment or intimidation as used to happen in the past. And that is exactly what is going on. So, I mean, the media is very vibrant at the moment, and, you know, they are writing, or the newspapers are writing whatever they want, and without anybody harassing them. And so is the private radio stations as well. Everybody, all the journalists are doing their work without any harassment whatsoever.
And I was reading a story also about Gambia having its first, what, private television station in so many years, so many decades?
Yes, that's true. This, I mean, for the first time in the history of the Gambia, we've got a private television. I mean, we used to have we had a television, but that was the government-owned television station, which virtually was doing the government bidding. But for the first time in the history of this country, we've now got a private television. And then, you know, I can assure you there are even more applications for private TV. And very soon, I can assure you, I mean, we'll be having other private television stations in this country.
On the issue of democracy, entrenching democracy, or rebuilding Gambia's democratic institutions, I want you to talk to me about that first in terms of what your government is doing. And then on the issue of impunity, which I think is the demand of many Gambians, that those who commit human rights violations against the people, whether they are government officials, there should be some accountability.
Well, with regards to institutional reform, we are definitely in high gear because, institutions are there. I mean, they existed even in the past regime. Unfortunately, they have not been functioning effectively. You know, virtually we are having a one-man show in this country. You know, everything hinged around President Jammeh, and he was the one who would, you know, give the order and who would execute, I mean, everything. So, but for the first time, we are now having institutional reform, and institutions are being empowered, you know, to execute their functions without any interference from either the head of state or the, you know, the various government departments as well. In regards to the question of impunity, used to be the order of the day in this country when people who were supporters of the former regime used to commit all kinds of atrocities and other crimes, and they get away with it. But, I mean, this is no longer the case. I mean, the government is very, very conscious of, you know, the rule of law. And we are, in fact, even setting up what we call Truth, Reconciliation and the Reparations Commission. You know, that is a commission that will look at the past atrocities that have been committed in the past regime.
Demba Jao is Gambia's Minister of Information. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. Aisha Hamin's work ties in many elements from Afro-futuristic music and stories to the history of the slave trade and current migration issues. At the Raw Art Gallery this week, Hamin presented art that connects these themes with the story of Drexeya, which is a mythical underwater country populated by unborn children of pregnant African women who were thrown off slave ships. In the story, developed by an electronic music duo of the same name, the babies adapted how to breathe underwater while in their mother's wombs. Hamin talked to Ricky Shryak about how current migration and music have ties to this story.
This is something that's pressing and it's ongoing and it's not resolved, and I think it's only getting heightened. Like, as we talked about during the session, that apart from the few examples that I brought up, that there's other ways to sort of think about contemporary slavery, of jettison in the present, etc. My own academic work was on the Black Atlantic, but the kind of art, my art practice and my kind of more activist practice has been in contemporary migration. So in a sense, the analogy sort of came quite organically from thinking those two things together. And then I realized it wasn't that abstracted.
The tying in of Afrofuturistic music, it's really fascinating. Why do you think that adds an element to presenting the work and maybe even raising awareness, like we said, about contemporary issues and tying the past to what's going on?
Well, that's really funny, actually, because my background's not in music, but I came across Drexeya a few years ago and was so taken with this story that they had of slaves who were thrown overboard. It's absolutely fascinating. And this idea of taking such a violent history and then turning it into this story of survival, right? And not only survival, but really almost joyful survival, because actually what happens is that these Drexians, they adapt from living in amniotic fluid to underwater, which is just completely violent image. But then they develop gills, they develop flippers, they start jumping the waves, and then they jump it, like, into outer space. They colonize a planet. And when in interviews that I've read with Drexia, they don't actually often make reference to this originary story that I mentioned in my talk. They actually more just talk about the different forms of mutation that they perform underwater. So in a way, to me, that became such an interesting way of, like, staying with the troubles.
That was Aisha Hamid, a lecturer in visual culture at Goldsmiths University in London. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with reactions from Friday's draw of the 2018 Russia World Cup, where Nigeria's Super Eagles will confront two-time world champions Argentina for the fifth time at the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. The final World Cup draw on Friday at the State Kremlin Palace in Moscow, Russia, pitched Nigeria in Group D together with Argentina, Croatia, and newcomers Iceland. Super Eagles coach Garrett Ra says his group is an interesting one.
To play this team also, the Argentina we know that Argentina is a very good team, but we know them a little bit. It will be more difficult now than in the friendly. Iceland is a very good team also, very strong physically. So we'll be interesting group.
And now to East Africa, where Kenya's Harambee Stars got their 2017 Council for East and Central Africa Football Association competition, popularly known as the SACAFA Senior Challenge Cup, off to a cracking start by defeating Rwanda's Amavubi 2-0 in a thrilling Group A match at the Bukungu Stadium in Kakamega. Paul Put is the new manager of the Harambee Stars.
First game in the tournament, it's very important that you get the good result. I think against Rwanda, who is playing or qualified for CHAN, you know they have quality in the team.
And later today, Uganda will hope to start their 2017 SACAFA Senior Challenge Cup with a win as they face Burundi in Group B. The Cranes were supposed to kick off their tournament against the Warriors of Zimbabwe, but the Southern Africans pulled out as guests at the 11th hour, citing insecurity in Kenya as a reason. In women's football on the continent, the Nigerian national women's under-17 team, the Flamingos, secured a morale-boosting 1-1 draw with Ethiopia in the first leg of their 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier in Addis Ababa on Sunday. Elsewhere, the South African under-17 women's national team, the Bantwana, defeated Botswana 5-1 in the first leg round of the 2018 FIFA under-17 women's World Cup qualifier. We stay in Southern Africa, but this time around Zambia, where Zesco United are the new champions of Zambia after they defeated hard-fighting Mafulira Wanderers 3-2 to reclaim the Zambian Super League title from closest challengers Zanaco on Saturday. Prior to the match, Zesco, Zanaco and Nkana were all in contention for the title. Away from football news now, South African rugby national coach Alistair Kotze remains adamant he will not resign from his post despite a shambolic 2-year term at the helm. Kotze oversaw yet another defeat at the weekend, this time a 24-22 defeat to Wales in Cardiff. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you a summary of Africa news, the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe says lifting U.S. sanctions on Zimbabwe would depend on positive actions by the new government. And that's it for this Monday, December 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Jackson Vunganyi, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a productive week, Africa.